taken a long time to distill out again the original form of religious worship that was the center and has still remained to be the esoteric center of both Judaism and Christianity, as well as Islam and Mahayana Buddhism and religious Taoism. So five of the world's great religions are founded on the same archetypal ceremony. And the only place in the world that it was ever accurately intact in one place was in Alexandria of the first century BC and probably the first quarter of the first century AD. By about 35 AD, this ceremony would have changed, already begun to have changed and evolved. So patiently, having distilled it over a long period of time and having refined it to the point to where we can now perform it so that we can have a critical appreciation, observe what happens, what is said, and after a break, have a critique, consciousness. We have to know where we came from. We have to understand what was the geometric center point from which our very complicated history radiated. And if we do not, we will just continue to flounder in a pattern which is no longer viable. The only way out is to be able to consciously see where we have come from, what kind of purposes are structurally endemic in our psyche, what kind of forms do we have that are workable. And with those purposes and with those tools, we can begin to envision ways to continue new purposes, transforming the old in ways that we see fit, transforming the old in ways of inner necessity, as Kandinsky will tell us. And it is simply the only way to go. And apparently we're not going to be let off the planet until we can do this. And so the time for getting born out into the cosmos is really here. And I think on Tuesday night, with my friend Sidney Lanier conducting the ceremonial aspect of it, we'll have a good view of an actual experience document, one that I think can be trusted. The other thing I've been working on since 1965 is to try and develop an educational pattern that is full enough to take cognizance of all of our protean capacities and at the same time make us sensitive and responsive to the entire spectrum of world culture. It isn't just a renaissance of the West by a new Asian influence. It isn't just a renaissance of the world by a scientific breakthrough, series of breakthroughs. It isn't just a renaissance of a rediscovery of classical learning. The scale is almost unnerving. 500 years ago, the recovery of the actual books of classical Greece in Florence produced a catastrophic change in the way in which Europeans were able to conceive of themselves. We live 500 years later. The scope and the possibilities of what we could call a Renaissance today are so much greater that they use the entire solar system as opposed to just the city limits of Florence. It gives you some idea of the scale, of the enormity. But there is not an educational pattern which is able to be responsive to that full picture. Nor is there an educational program deep enough to elicit out from our own inner capacities the undiscovered purposes and the materials and the insights that the Tuesday evenings are set to try and reconstruct. So the Saturday class represents now almost a quarter of a century of work in trying to spin this out. And all along I've been somehow given gifted circumstances. By the age of 29, I was already in charge of a 16-course program of designing it. I don't know how all this comes about, synchronistically, perhaps, but I do know that this Saturday program works. It's been refined enough. And the first year was apparent by 1975, the first four sections, which seemed on the surface to be the standard quaternary of the development of the self. And indeed it is. And the first year is very sound. And by 1975, I had understood it extremely well, had correlated the material, the forms, had checked it out, had seen it work with over 1,000 students, had run that program for 5 years in a school with all kinds of capacities, since I was ostensibly the chairman of the department, the designer of the program, had unlimited freedom, funds, space, conditions, whatever it was. But in trying to reformulate that program in 1976, and it was going to be offered at Northrop University here in Los Angeles, and the president of Northrop, B.J. Schell, was an extremely intelligent man and understood that only in an engineering scientific context can a truly universal development of man take place. Science and technology and engineering are to us today what painting and sculpture and architecture was 500 years ago. But one of the vicissitudes of contemporary history, the Ayatollah Khomeini taking over in Iran and cutting off the funds to the wealthy Persian students, Iranian students, and one-third of Northrop's student body were Iranian students, if you can believe it, cut off. And the university simply suffered an economic collapse and could not initiate a new program. But in trying to find a way to run this first year at Northrop, I found that there was still an undeveloped dimension which was not taken care of in the first year. The undeveloped dimension is specifically consciousness, not just the development from nature to the self, but a complementary movement of the return of consciousness from the self back to nature as a cosmos, back to nature as a scientifically inquired about cosmos. The cosmos is not to be understood as something closed and finished, but in a scientific sense, a realm to be explored, to be inquired after, to be pioneered in, but nevertheless a conscious realm. It's different from being gaga under the star-spangled night out in the desert, from being able to know that such and such stars and constellations are in one arm of our galaxy, and that there is such a thing as a galaxy, and another set are in another arm of the galaxy. and that there are many galaxies like this. It's a totally different reality when one knows this. When one can look at the bright blue star and not see Sothis as a mythological figure, but understand that it is a blue-white giant with a white dwarf companion about 7 light years away that has a planetary system, just like our star has. It's a whole different perspective. But the development of consciousness is radically different from the education of consciousness, is radically different from the development of the self. The self is a movement towards integration, but consciousness is a movement towards differentiation. And it's almost as if one has to go against the natural grain in order to learn consciously. It seems like that. It's not true, but it certainly seems like that. And for a feeling-based personality, it is almost impossible to do this. The feeling-based personality has to transform, has to heighten itself, has to raise the vibration from feeling to thought, from feeling to thinking. But in doing so, has to learn not to throw feeling away, not to discard all those capacities. And so one is faced with the paradox of higher education. The education of consciousness, civilization, is a paradoxical process. And to tend to this took an awful long time to puzzle out. And I think we have it now. I think that this the second year is as solid as the first year, as far as I can see in testing it. Now the difficulty with the second year is that those who found that they were doing well in the first year, who were integrating, are now unconsciously jeopardized by a sense of maybe losing confidence in that integration. As you look around, you can see a great number of people who flourished here in the first year are not here. It is characteristic of this. So it's important to continue, but to continue with the sense that while we worked with one hand before, we're working with the other hand now, we're still working with a graspable condition, which is familiar to all of us. In the second year, in the development of consciousness, the fulcrum of the whole development is the development of the person. The development of the person is the quintessential act of consciousness. And while the process could be enunciated in a rather mechanical way, I think, therefore I am, the true beginning is the ability to characterize myself as I. More profound than the statement, I think, therefore I am, is the identity of the I in the I think with the I in the I am. And that presupposition that I may characterize myself as an I is the profound insight which eluded Descartes, as it eludes all rationalistic, limited thinkers. The ability to characterize myself as I is profound. And that I must be born. That I must emerge. Just as the physical body has emerged, has been born, the I must be born. And the only place the I can be born is out of the self. It's the inner womb that is the parent to the identity of the person. There can be no other source. Anything else is a chimera. Anything else is speculative. But because the inner self is so mysterious, because the focus of all integration is so mysterious, that the origins of the person, the origins of my I, are obscure. So that we have a very difficult realization to bring ourselves to. And the area of human endeavor that most characteristically expresses this development is art. Art is the capacity whereby we emerge as a person. Just as every time one sees a work of art, the presupposition there is that there is an artist. A symphony doesn't just happen. A building, which is architecturally sound, doesn't just happen. It's like Louis Sullivan saying to the young Frank Lloyd Wright. He said, Wright, you're a good designer, but you don't understand architecture yet. Behind every building that you see is a man that you don't see, the architect. Make the building express the architect. And Wright outdid the master. He saw deeper than Sullivan. Sullivan saw the personality of the building in its structure and in its ornament. And Wright saw it as the structure penetrated by the space. The ornament enlivened with a geometry. And even though the lesson has been wrung dry by the late 1980s, and the international style has become just a cardboard manipulation of economic factors, the original insight in Wright's mind was amazingly accurate and truthful. But the point here for us is that art is that realm of human experience where person making is the real ultimate, the real fulcrum. So when we come to art, as we've come now, for the next 3 months, our concern is to expose ourselves to as many ways of artistic activity as we can in this short time, of poetry, of painting, of sculpture, a sense of composition, a sense of design, a sense of creativity. But underlying it all, this quality of remembering, not just imagining and creating, but remembering who we are. Who are we as we do this? Now, one of the great watersheds in world civilization has just been passed. And the difference between 1880 and 1930 is an enormous difference. Those 50 years are just an incredible difference. One can even squeeze it together and put it down to 1920, 22, around in there, and move it up from 1880 to the mid-1880s. In that generation or two, we passed through a threshold. Now, I did a whole course a number of years ago on the 19th century, on the characteristic of the 19th century, and the overwhelming characteristic of the 19th century was the dematerialization of form. From 1800 to 1900, there's a consistent landslide of dematerialization of form. You go from the certainty of priestly finding oxygen as an element to James Clerk Maxwell at the end of the 19th century, understanding that the electromagnetic theory doesn't deal with any kind of material at all, but deals with an energy which is characterized only by very high mathematical expression. And from Priestley to Maxwell is an incredible odyssey of science and dematerialization. But the true barometer of the human significance is always recorded in the art. And the 19th century art history is a record of the dematerialization. Now, towards the end of the 19th century, the dematerialization had happened in such a way, a characteristic way, that as you dematerialize the world, it becomes more and more apparent that the true focus is inside. That the true focus, instead of being formal outside, is, if there's any formality, inside. And the characteristic art movement towards the end of the 19th century in poetry was symbolism. Symbolism. And its correlative in painting was impressionism. Now, symbolism in poetry and impressionism in painting are going to be keys for us. And I'm going to give you a little bit of symbolism today in poetry. And next week I'll go into impressionism a little bit in painting. But the true development of symbolism and impressionism were when they came together in the early 20th century and transformed. Because the dematerialization of the external world, which emphasizes the internal world, the symbolic, emphasizes the self. One doesn't stop at the self. There's no place to stop there. There's not a point there. There's no glue there that you stop at, but you go through that focus and come back out in another way. You come back out like Alice going through the looking glass. You come out in Wonderland. And if the 20th century is anything at all, it's the wonderland behind the mirror of the 19th century. The great physicist George Gamow wrote a couple of entertaining books of Mr. Tompkins in Wonderland. I have some copies of them here. You can take a look later on. It's the perfect understanding of what has happened in the 20th century. We went through a threshold somewhere between 1880 and 1920, and we went through the mirror. We went through the mirror of the self. We went through that capacity where integration was enormously important to where differentiation is desperately important. And if there's a battle cry in the 20th century, it's give me space and give me room, give me freedom, give me time to sort it out, to articulate it, to differentiate. So much so that the pressures of integration are seen as a threat by the surviving generation. And almost in a subconscious way, people have their little outriggers and hackles of sensitivity, and they rise up and say, well, wait a minute, this integration business, this is too hard for me. I can't take it. It's too much pressure. But because of recognizing in, again, an unconscious overall way the need for it, surrogate integrations, imaginative integrations are substituted for the true integration. And you find all kinds of third-rate teachers and fourth-rate doctrines being bandied around and popular. And you find now in our time just everything awash with speculative integrations by persons who have no deep inner self experience at all. It's a characteristic of the 20th century. It's a characteristic of the strategic movement of history and of world civilization. One of the best insights, if you wish to get a little philosophic about this, Mircea Eliade's book on the myth of the eternal return, the section on the terror of history for modern man. And he lays it out in a beautiful language. And you could apprise yourself of the situation by taking a look at that volume. Princeton University Press has it in paperback. So art is the art of person making, but it is a function of consciousness, and it does not have nature as its referent but the self. And yet the self is the ultimate distillation of nature. So there is a paradox here. Yes, art has something to do with nature, but art and nature are, as we would say, mystically akin. Whereas art and self are consciously related. And it takes a great deal of sophistication to be able to have a differentiable art. Now, a great art that's integral, like, say, Dante, the Divine Comedy, is quintessentially the movement from a natural image base to the development of the symbolic self. And it's exactly that prototype that is anathema in the 20th century. Why? Because its ability to bring together is so effective that it constitutes a high-pressure diamond-making capacity inside. And if your need is differentiation, that's exactly the wrong energy. It's exactly what you fear, what you don't want to have. So in our educational sequence, over the 2 years, we're dealing together with two very powerful movements that, in a grand overview, move exactly opposite to one another. In fact, this was the old cliche of hermetically sealed, that when one has a being that has been developed with both movements together, their being together is hermetically sealed. There is no way to pull them apart. Once they are developed in that way, they're eternal. That being is not subject to decay on any level, in any dimension. So we're dealing here in art with an extremely powerful focus of the development of consciousness, which strategically is differentiation, so that you might, in a colloquial way, just think for yourself that with symbolism, with impressionism, with the development of abstract style, with the development of modern art, one of the key terms that you might want to familiarize yourself with is expression. And a correlate term is experience. And where experience and expression are affine, one has then the dimensions wherein art operates. It's just a little way of orienting yourself. It's a way, it's like a litmus test of just beginning. Well, so much for that introduction. Now, the two books that I hope that you're finding, Kandinsky's Concerning the Spiritual and Art, the edition I have has been out of print for about 25 years, but Dover Paperbacks has for $2.95 a little paperback. I saw a bunch of them at the Philosophic Research Society, and almost any of the art museum bookstores around town will have it. Concerning the Spiritual Nard by Kandinsky. The other one is Euripides' Bacchae. Now, just for visual check, how many have found a copy of Euripides? Could you raise your hand? 1, 2, 3, 4. So, 2/3 of you have not even gone out and got a copy of one of the basic things that we're working on. If we were in an old-fashioned teaching thing, I would ask you to go and get it now, and I'll wait. How many have Kandinsky's volume? How many found that? Okay. We're going to concentrate on Kandinsky this week and on Euripides next week, and then the following week I'm going to bring them together. Not that Kandinsky and Euripides can be mulched together, but that their concerns are extremely important when viewed in sync. It's like if you see a bird like a robin or a sparrow hunting for food and see it peck around and hop around, and you think that's how all birds hunt. But if you see a pair of hawks hunting, it's quite a different phenomenon from sparrows hopping around or finches hopping around. The hawks always hunt in pairs, and they always have a coordinated ballet of circling together and creating a visual terrain for themselves, wherein the prey can be seen very, very long distance, very refined. We're trying to be like hawks. We're trying to be like great eagles. We're trying to understand something very subtle that hopping around and pecking is never going to find. One doesn't even know it exists. So we're going to use Kandinsky and Euripides as our hawks in this motion. Now, I want to give you a little bit of experience. I want to give you 4 poets in a sequence. The first poet is the great French symbolist Mallarmé. The second poet is the great symbolist in English language, W.B. Yeats. And then the third poet who brought together Mallarmé and Yeats to a perfection of symbolic poetical form, T.S. Eliot. And then I want to give you Matsuo Basho, who shows a transcendent symbolism. But a transcendent symbolism that takes advantage of another key, impressionism. Now, next week I'll develop from Basho the way in which symbolic impressions are extremely powerful of revealing the inner self. And the artist that I'm going to use next week is Ando Hiroshige. And I'll show you some slides of Hiroshige. And then I'll show you some slides of Monet, who had one of the 2 largest collections of Hiroshige prints. The other person was Frank Lloyd Wright. Both Monet and Frank Lloyd Wright learned to see penetratively by Hiroshige. And Hiroshige is one of the great artists of the world. But in order to prepare ourselves for this, I want to first establish a sense of symbolism in language and then show you how Basho's haiku is symbolic in a different way. That instead of using images to construct the symbolic web, Basho takes a single image and shines it to transparency. It is a radical development. It is a radical tool of consciousness. It's the difference between somebody who is able to think symbolically and someone who is like a Zen master, who doesn't use any images to think with at all. Not at all. When old Huang Po found the right student, the saying is it was like two open doors facing one another. So first the symbolist, and then to Basho, as a comparison, but as also an extension to a penetration. So that Mallarmé, Yeats, Eliot, and Basho are all symbolic poets, but Basho is symbolic to the point of penetrating through the symbolic to something else, to consciousness, pure consciousness. Now for Mallarmé, for Yeats, for Eliot, the consciousness is always consciousness of and in terms of the imagery, even when it's attenuated to a symbolic pattern, it's still a consciousness in terms of the symbolic imagery that's used, whereas Basho takes it the one step further and pokes through the mirror and goes into Wonderland, goes through the other side. So here's the sequence, and you can hear this on the cassette if you can't find it for yourself. This is the University of California Press edition of some of Mallarmé's poems, translated by C.F. McIntyre. I don't know if it's still in print or not. This is one of the best little translations. You can, of course, read, if you can read French, Mallarmé's French is much more exquisite than the English. I won't read the Mallarmé poem that was most influential, The Afternoon of a Faun. Debussy set it to music, and William Faulkner wrote a little bit of a skit about it, and it influenced a whole generation, was the epitome of the time. We don't have time to read the whole thing and go into it, so I'm going to read you two paragraphs, two stanzas, two selections, which gives you just the characteristics of Mallarmé. This is from page 21 of the University of California Press edition, and this is the incantation from a little sequence called Herodiade. Abolished and her frightful wings in the tears of the pool. Abolished that mirrors her alarms, the naked gold's thrashing crimson space, an aurora has heraldic plumage, chosen our cinerary and sacrificial tower, heavy tomb whence a beautiful bird has fled, solitary caprice of dawn with vain black plumage, ah, the manor house of sad and fallen land. No plashing, the gloomy water is resigned, no longer visited by plume or swan, never forgotten. The water reflects the yielding of on autumn, extinguishing therein his torch. Of the swan, when amid the pallid mausoleum, he plunged his feathery head in grief for the pure diamond of some star, but long ago, a star that never scintillated. An example of great French symbolist imagery leading to an implosion of the self very accurately. A star, though, that never scintillated. It never twinkled. It never... The second... Plusieurs Sonnets, page 83, four little stanzas that go together. Again, Mallarmé. Again, the epitome of French symbolist poetry, the epitome of what in the late 19th century would have been high consciousness, that there is a mysterious integration going on and all forms are crushing together into some mysterious other. Mallarmé. The lively, lovely, and virginal today will its drunken wings tear for us with a blow. This lake, hard and forgotten, haunted below the frost by the clear glacier of flights not made. A swan of past times remembers he's the one magnificent, but striving without hope for not having sung a land where he could stop when the ennui of sterile winter has shone. All his neck will shake off this white death by space inflicted on the bird for whom it is not. But never the horror of clay where his feathers are caught. Phantom whose pure white dooms it to this place, swathed in futile exile with a chill dream of contumely, the swan is still. So there's a couple of examples of Mallarmé. Just take them in. The second in the sequence, Yeats. This is the early Yeats. This is from The Rose, the little volume The Rose, published in 1893. Yeats was in his 20s, mid-20s. This is the famous poem, The Lake Isle of Innisfree. Symbolism, integration, implosion to the self. But where has one gotten to? Yeats. I will arise and go now and go to Innisfree, and a small cabin build there, of clay and wattles made. 9 bean rows will I have there, a hive for the honeybee, and live alone in the bee-loud glade. And I shall have some peace there, for peace comes drooping slow, dropping from the veils of the morning to where the cricket sings. There's midnight's all a glimmer, and noon a purple glow, and evening full of the linnet's wings. I will arise and go now, for always night and day I hear lake water lapping with low sounds by the shore. While I stand on the roadway or on the pavements gray, I hear it in the deep heart's core. And then the third one in the sequence, T.S. Eliot from 30 years later, 1922, the opening of The Wasteland, The Burial of the Dead. This is direct movement from Mallarmé to Yeats to Eliot. It's about 40 years of time compressed here in these three selections. Again, the implosion to the self, the crumpling of the entire image base, but where is one? then.
April is the cruelest month, breeding lilacs out of the dead land, mixing memory and desire, stirring dull roots with spring rain. Winter kept us warm, covering earth in forgetful snow, feeding a little life with dried tubers. Summer surprised us, coming over the Starnbergese. With a shower of rain, we stopped in the colonnade and went on in sunlight into the Hofgarten and drank coffee and talked for an hour. Bin gar kein Russen, stamos lauten ich Deutsch. And when we were children staying at the Archduke's, my cousins, he took me out on a sled and I was frightened. He said, Marie, Marie, hold on tight, and down we went. In the mountains, there you feel free.